And
to have a
well,
come
week
back to the film
another
real cast.
film, and this week we're going to talk about what happens when you go to work and your boss really hates you. So it's something we all have every single day, no doubt. And to discuss that, I have the intellects, the brains. No, I don't actually. I've got Steve and Kelly back on the pod. How are both of you?
I'm good.
I'm good after that. Thanks.
It's a nice intro, isn't it?
Yeah.
I thought, what should I say? I thought, let's just go for good old honesty at the end of the day. You just can't beat it. People have listened to this enough. They know what it's like. So who am I kidding?
Exactly. Honesty is the best policy.
That's what they say. A bit harsh, really.
Yeah.
I could have said beauty and like the brains and like, let you guys just fight it out, because that's what we're going to do in this podcast, no doubt, when we're talking about this film.
Yeah, I can see that.
But we are doing the Belko experiment, made in 2016, directed by Greg McLean, written by James Gunn from Guardians of the Galaxy, Sliver, Super, and Movie 43, and a lot more. And obviously, if it's got James Gunn, then it's going to have somewhere in the cast Sean Gunn. And it does, funnily enough. His little shadow is always there. And before we read this, obviously, I was looking through Amazon, and it just come up. And I was like, fuck it, this is a really weird film. Let's do it. Had you guys seen it before? Obviously, I'm kind of directing this more at Steve, because you don't even watch adverts most of the time, Kels, when it's on TV.
But, we never watch adverts. Who watches adverts now?
So, but have you guys heard of this or seen this before?
No, never in my life had I heard of this film.
No, I hadn't heard of it either.
Well, there you go. It's all a learning curve. Every day is a school day. And I've seen this advertised, and I just thought, you know what? It's going to be something different. Plus, it wasn't a very long film. It's only something like 88 minutes long. So it's pretty good. But for a film that's obviously no one's heard of, it's under the radar, it's got a lot of people who are kind of, it's that guy from, I mean, I don't know how many people you recognise, Carol, but it's got a lot of people in from other series that's been on TV.
I recognised a couple, but not many.
Who do you recognise? Tell me. I want to know. Amaze me. Go on.
John McGinley and Michael, is it Rooker?
Well done, you. I'm quite proud. I am very, very proud.
Thanks. Oh, and the weirdo that smokes pot. What's his name?
That's Sean Gunn.
Him.
Yeah. Yeah, you would have noticed him from Guardians of the Galaxy. That's when he kind of stands out more.
Oh, I don't know if I noticed him from that. I have seen Guardians of the Galaxy, actually. Yes, I have.
I think with your other half, the chances are you would have seen Guardians of the Galaxy.
Yes,
to
I have.
Definitely. What about yourself, Steve, with the cast?
So, Sean Gunn, Michael Rooker, John McGinley, Leandra, I recognise her from somewhere. I can't remember where. Michael Rooker's matey boy, because he's been in Ant-Man. Can't remember what his name is. So yeah, it is a lot of, I know him, but I can't remember where I know him from.
Yeah, definitely. It's the cast is, weirdly enough, the only one who I kind of thought, I haven't seen you before, was John Gallagher Jr., who plays Mike Milch, who's like kind of the star of this. But he's been in 10 Cloverfield Lane, Peppermint and Hush. Hush is a really good film as well. You've got Tony Goldwyn, who plays Barry Norris. He's the president in Scandal. Adriana Arjona, who's Leandra Flores, who plays... She's in Person of Interest in True Detective. And obviously, John C. McKinley's famously in Scrubs and in The Rock. And you've also, obviously, Sean Gunn. He's in everything that his brother actually does. And you've got a couple of people from The Mentalist, who's Vince Agostino. He's in The Mentalist, Brent Sexton. And then you've got someone else. You've got Owen Yeoman, who plays Terry Winter. He's the detective in The Mentalist. So you've got quite a few people. Obviously, you've got Michael Rooker as Yondu. So there's lots of people in this who I just thought, wow, this is a really bizarre film. And they're kind of starring in it. A lot of them are TV actors, though. But for once, this film was at the cinema. Whether it wasn't in this country, I don't think. But the budget was $5 million, which must have gone to the I don't know. I wouldn't call them A-listers in this film, would you?
A minus listers, because I wouldn't say they're awful. I don't think they're like bad actors or anything in this, but they're not top of the range selection, are they?
No, I'd probably only from Guardians Walking Dead put Michael Rooker above everyone else, I would have thought, but mainly because he's been in TV movies. But I don't know, because when you look at John McKinley, he's like really well known. He's in his career, he's more known for Scrubs for me. I don't know what you guys know him from.
Scrubs.
Scrubs.
Yeah, it's got to be. He's so good in that, isn't he? He's absolutely fantastic. But the budget, as I say, was 5 million, and this made just over 11 million worldwide. So it's not really a massive hit, but I've never heard of it. I don't know why. I mean, you've got Guardians of the Galaxy was in 2014. That was so original, so different. And this came out in 2016. But for some reason, it just appears not to have been kind of picked up, does it?
No, but you get a lot of those films because I don't think this is a terrible film. I think it would have done very well had it been like pushed a bit more in terms of advertising. But it's just turned into one of those below radar. It's not a golden nugget.
It's not a cult film by any means, is it, this?
But it's not completely unforgettable. Forgettable, completely forgettable.
I get confused with stuff like that, honestly. I'm getting corrected all the time. I
Why
really
would
do.
anyone say it's completely unforgettable? Yeah, but you know what I mean. Like,
Yeah.
it does its thing, so you remember it.
I get confused with not missing stuff and missing stuff when I try
No,
and say, I don't miss doing that. I say it the wrong way around. And I'm always corrected, aren't I, Kelly?
I don't know what you're talking about. I haven't said a word.
You're a rotten liar. You really are a terrible liar. It's absolutely shocking. I would not want you to provide an alibi for me if I'd done something wrong, honestly.
No, my poker face is pretty shit, to be honest.
Yeah, I kind of gathered that. So,
Yeah.
but this plot, I don't know whether you guys have seen it, draws really heavy from, I think it's 2000, Battle Royale, which is a cult film. I don't know if either of you guys have seen that.
No, I've
Kel?
not even heard of that one either. No,
That's.
you know the answer. You don't really need to ask me. I like the fact that you do. I appreciate that, but you know the answer.
Well, you've surprised me on a few things, haven't you, that I didn't think you'd actually seen and or even heard of, and you've seen them.
True, I suppose.
So I would like to give you that respect and just ask you, Steve, have you seen Battle Royale?
Surprisingly, no, I haven't, but I am aware of it.
It's a really, really good film. It's very close to the mark. It's where the Hunger Games got there. Well, they really ripped a lot from Battle Royale. It's a lot of school kids it's put on this bus and they go to this island. I think it's an island. And when they get there, they're just given a bag of weapons. And then they're just sent out to this island where they must kill each other. And the school teacher is kind of in charge of everything to make sure the kids do kill each other. It's really, really good film. It's obviously very brutal because it's kids killing other kids. But it's done so well, and it is a cult film, and it's kind of, when you watch it, you'll understand why it's such a cult film. It's brilliant. But this one obviously has ripped from that, but in a lot kind of closer environment, an office block. And for those who haven't seen this, I will read a synopsis. Mike Milch, an employee of Belco Industries, a remote office building in rural Bogota, Colombia. He turns up for work with unfamiliar security guards, turning away local Colombian staff at the gate. Danny Wilkins reports for a first day on the job and told that a tracking device is implanted to the base of the skull for every employee in case they get kidnapped. Soon a voice comes over the speaker system telling every staff to execute another in a battle royale style death match until there's only one employee standing. But during the start of
Wow.
this, you see Mike Milch going to work in Bogota, which is a fucking shithole of a place. It really is. They don't sell it very well. And it's strange because you've got some guy selling some half-eaten corn on the cob figure. Which does come into it that it turns out everyone who's holding that lives. It is a genuine good luck figure in this film. But you've got those kids playing with those kind of death, like skull Halloween masks. And for some reason, this really freaks him out. There's one staring at him. And I don't quite get why it freaked him out, because surely this must be a daily occurrence of him going to work, wouldn't it?
I kind of figured there would be some reference to it, and that was like a foreshadowing for something happening later on in the film, because obviously I had no idea what it was about. But it doesn't really appear there'd be that. So it's a bit odd.
Yeah, it's really strange. And when they get to work, you see Barry Norris, who's I think is like the CEO of Belco Industries, that there's different security guards there and that locals are being turned away. You'd think that someone would question this, wouldn't you, more?
Would you? I don't know. If you go through security checks and stuff and things like that, just because it's changed, would you question it more, or would you go in and be like, what's going on? If people go, I don't know, you kind of go, oh, okay. I don't know that you would.
You absolutely would.
I don't know that
Abs
you would.
abs you absolutely would. Why
No, I
wouldn't
don't think you
you?
would. Because if you've got security, just because they're different security, why does that immediately go, oh, that's dodgy?
What, and you find out people are being turned away, like locals are being turned away. You'd be like, oh, okay, just guess mixing things up.
Well, no, because one of them, I can't remember which one, says it's something to do with a security breach or something, doesn't they come up and say there's some kind of intel or something like that that's been given to them. So they're just turning away all locals.
I
I
think
think that.
they just use that as I think to kind of reassure themselves. I don't think they really know why. No one's actually told them. I think it's just what they think themselves possibly it could be. But it's clear that they think there's a place. Oh, it goes, there's a bomb threat because they search under the car with the mirrors. And everything's heavy-handed. Even a CEO isn't recognized. He has to hand over his ID. So
See,
clearly,
that's
all the
weird.
personnel's new.
Yeah, but not knowing who the big boss is, that is strange. You would think, doesn't matter who they are, you'd know who your boss is.
I turn around and fuck off. I have to admit, it got to this. I would turn around and just go. Well, I don't really care about work anyway. So, and it's not
I don't
clear
know
what
that
these
you
people
would.
do.
I don't know that you would.
You don't know Stu.
I kind of do.
Okay, you do, but you don't know what he would do in a situation
I
like
think
that.
if you're the sort of person to go and work somewhere like this and go, yeah, okay, fit a tracker to my skull, oh, please monitor me. If you're that kind of a person, you're not going to question it.
I wonder how much they got offered to be paid to go and work there.
That's what I'd like to know. I'd like to know a bit more about this company. They're just kind of like an intermediary company in South America, aren't they? And
Yeah.
they don't really go into great detail. And I like the fact that everyone is naive to the fact of what's going on with this experiment. So, for example, when you get Danny Wilkins come in for our first day, she's told by, I think it's Brent, that this is what happens. Everyone has a tracker in their head. Don't worry about it.
Okay, and you saw the doctor yesterday?
For the tracer, you mean?
It's for your own protection. There's dozens of kidnappings every year here in Colombia, usually from companies like ours. But with that sucker, they can locate you anywhere, anytime, no problem.
And some of them we learn that have had these trackers in their head for like over a year. So it kind of shows how sinister it is and how long they've been planning everything. There's no one in on the inside who's in the know, which I think is a really good twist because it would have been so easy to have someone in there making sure, like setting everyone up, kind of herding the cattle in the right direction for them. But that isn't the case here. It's literally like Lord of the Flies, isn't it?
Yeah, which makes it better because then it just instills more panic in people because everyone is against everyone.
Yes, and as we said in other horror films, like when we did Wrong Turn and everything, that the kind of the trope of the horror film is to get the ordinary person, the hero, to turn into something that they're initially frightened of, like the monster, where they turn into a killer and they do things that they wouldn't do. And this film really kind of like flips it on the head that everyone is like that. But they do have some very strange conversations, but before we kind of they get to the tannoy, which kind of kicks everything off. When you see John McGinley's character, he can only really play, apart from when he's in The Rock, which I don't like that film, to be honest. He's like a stereotypical male chauvinist, isn't he? And he plays that role here really well, doesn't he?
A creep.
It's just the look he's got, which isn't really a compliment, but it is just the look he has. He does just look like a weird sleaze.
Yeah, I think he is like, he kind of goes to quoting later on in the film where he's called a pervert, where Leandra, I think it is, calls him a pervert because he's messaging her via like the company's kind of like Skype equivalent, being quite inappropriate, and she tells him to fuck himself. But he says, like, later on, don't call me a pervert. So it's one of those things where serial killers don't like to be called serial killers, or mad people don't like to be called mad. I think he is a genuine, like Oscar from Halloween, who I'll never forget, a sexual deviant.
You're obsessed with him. He wasn't that bad.
He was. He used friendship as weakness to try and get into that girl's knickers, and he fucked it up and he got killed and deserved to.
It's unlucky that he fucked it up, but don't a lot of people start things from friendship?
Well, serial killers.
Okay.
I get what you're saying, but Oscar deserved to die and it was a really good death. John McKinley, he is a fucking deviant. And we soon learn that Mike Milch, who, as I say, I wouldn't describe him as the hero in this film, to be honest. I really wouldn't. He's a survivor. He's in a relationship with Leandra. I think he is honestly punching. He really, really is. What about you, Steve?
Right. So I have a thing about this because I was going to say the exact same thing. And I don't like to do this because it's not what we do on the Film Real Cast, but from a looks point of view, he is punching. Yeah. Personality point of view, she is punching. She's got a stinking attitude on her and she pisses me off later on in the film. And I was like, if she had done that to me, I'd cave her head in.
Oh, he has a chance here to do that.
Yeah, and exactly. And that's the point. Like when we're trying to dwindle numbers down later, and she's got a stinking attitude and she's making me look stupid, I'll be like, right, well, if you don't want to get on board with my plan, off you pop.
Yeah.
So let me just get this right. If she doesn't do what you say...
Okay, right. It sounds bad, but in the circumstances of the film... in the circumstances of the film, when it gets to a point where they have to kill 30 people and she's being a bit of a bitch... It still sounds bad, but I stand by it.
So you're standing by your coercive, controlling kind of leadership style.
Well, if any other person in the room, be them male, female, in a relationship with them or not, if they start undermining me, I'll cave their head in too.
Oh my God.
It's a very one-way street with you then, and your friendships and relationships. Do as I say or else.
The circumstances are different, girl. This is not just a day-to-day thing.
Okay, good to know your fighting style. Good to know.
That's fine. When we've seen you at work, you're often sitting on your own then.
That is strangely accurate, isn't it?
Yeah, it's so true. You've always been on your own. Now I know why, and that people say you're not approachable.
It's for their safety.
Exactly. Oh, never mind. And on we go from Steve's relationship styles. Excellent. If you want to catch more on our relationship podcast, you can join Steve next week on his own. We're also introduced to Keith McClure. And Keith is the geek with the ant farm. And he's just a genuinely nice guy, isn't he? And you see that instantly when he's talking to Peggy, the old lady.
Keith, one's loose.
Oh, shit. Okay. All right, here I come.
Tickles.
Oh, yeah. Obviously, that's John, of course.
Oh, although he prefers to be called Jake. He thinks it makes him sound tough.
Well, he looks very, very tough. You're very pretty. Honey, believe me, one more bad date and I am there.
Well, guard your heart. He's a total love him and leave him kind of guy.
And he's kind of being very charming and just flirting with her. And he's just a really harmless character. And I kind of thought he's going to go one of two ways, that you'll see Keith go absolutely fucking Rambo or he'll just become cannon fodder. And I didn't really mind kind of which way it went. He's quite a likable character, isn't he?
Yeah, he's another face I recognise, and I think every time I've seen him in another film, he's played a similar character, in a sense, a little bit likeable. Trying to think where I recognise him from.
He was in The Internship with Owen Wilson and Vincent Vaughn.
Yes, that's it. Yeah, because I watched that recently, and I like that film. Good film.
Yeah, and he's like a likeable character, a geek, but just has his whole character arc there, doesn't he? That he's on the periphery of everything, and then he just becomes really liked and confident and popular.
Yeah, typecast.
Yeah, very much so. It works well. And also, like the character Terry Winter from The Mentalist, he's quite a good looking guy, quite a big guy, and you think he's going to be very commanding and strong, quite a dominant figure. But he crumbles really quickly, doesn't he? As soon as this shit hits the fan and there's pressure, his character just goes in a completely opposite direction, I thought. He's a real hanger-on, especially to Barry Norris and Wendell Jukes, who's John McKinley. He's a real, like, lamb. He just follows them everywhere, doesn't he?
Yeah. What a loser.
Yeah, he's a sickening character. But the film is short, so it needs to kind of put these... like the plot together needs to start running pretty fast. But we do get the Tannoy come out. And when you think this is only 11 minutes into the film where everyone's told to stop what they're doing and pay attention.
All employees, no matter what you're doing, please stop and lend me your full attention. There are currently 80 of you in the building. In 8 hours, most of you will be dead. Your chance of survival increases by following my orders and excelling at the tasks I placed before you.
So if you were at work and this Tannoy system started coming out, which you didn't actually know about, and it told you that in 8 hours that most of you are going to be dead, and that in the next 2 hours you're going to have to kill 30 of your employees, what would your reaction be?
I genuinely don't know, because I wouldn't leave it, I don't think, because it would just be so surreal. So I would kind of like... I don't know. It would probably be once I saw stuff happening around me that was like, oh, okay, they're not joking. So it would wouldn't be until the shutters and everything for me. I don't think I would think it's real.
What about you, Steve?
Wouldn't hesitate.
You'd go straight. By the sounds of it, you'd just walk up to someone and just kill them straight away.
Yeah, yeah. Fucking don't have to tell me twice.
Do you know what I'm going to do next week? I'm going to try and find a Tannoy system and actually get this speech out onto the Tannoy system just to watch you kill someone just for a joke.
You should see me stand up from my chair, go, thank God, let's go.
You'll be standing there with a bloody stapler machine and, or a sellotape machine.
Kevin from accounts. We've got to have a conversation.
That would be so good. Surprise!
Yeah, it'd be stopping me. That's the issue.
Yeah, just the look on your face that you're enjoying it too much.
You're getting another Tannoy saying, no, just two. Just two.
But it's really good. I like the way that people don't take it serious. I mean, to be honest, even when the fire alarm goes off at work, I can't be fucked to move and I'll sit at my desk to try and style it out to see if it really is when the building can actually be ablaze. So if a Tannoy came out like that, saying you need to kill 30 people or go and meet in the... like the hall and 30 people are going to die, I'd go and do it just out of curiosity. But you'd never, ever believe it, especially people who have been working at this place for so many years and that have come and gone day to day. It's good. And I like people's reactions of they're waiting for others to react first, aren't they? To see, is someone going to start killing someone or is everyone going to take it a joke? Because you'd be so anxious, wouldn't you?
Straight away, be the dominant one.
Yeah.
But do you honestly think you could be that cool and calm and everything if that amount of panic and hysteria kicked in? Do you honestly think you can maintain your composure?
Absolutely. No question.
Yeah, I think that was going to be the answer. Yeah. Okay.
I've got to be honest, I knew that was going to be the answer as well. I was pretty confident. If it was scripted, that's what I'd have written down for Steve to read.
Right. Yeah.
But all the shutters come up and everyone's cell signal is blocked. The phones don't work. And that's when they really start to know that things are kind of turning a bit serious once the shutters come up. Because there is no way out. There is no communicating with anyone. And even then, they're trying to decide what to do.
Hey, listen up, everybody, okay? I'm Barry Norris, the COO here, for people who don't know. Listen. I'm aware that this is a very, hell, to say the least, a very strange situation here, but I don't believe there's any cause for panic, all right? We're still trying to figure out exactly what the situation is, but I'm certain there's a rational explanation. This is a government building.
And Michael Rooker, who I really thought, and bear in mind, we are going to spoil this film to bits and go through every character's death in a wonderful, gory way. I thought Michael Rooker was either something to do with it, because he's often a baddie, or he would be the remaining one, because he usually goes around and kicks ass. But they really keep you guessing, don't they, in this film?
Yeah, I always thought there was going to be like a big reveal.
What did you kind of think about a twist would be at the end?
Yeah, so I thought someone would reveal themselves as being in control of it or having some sort of connection to it.
Yeah.
So I was a bit thrown off.
Blimey.
I know. And normally I'm so on it.
You are. It sounds like you're being ridiculed by Kelly there, who was kind of following this pretty close. Am I right, Kel?
No, not at all. Mm-mm.
What, did you think there'd be a twist?
No, I thought there'd be more explanation. I didn't think there would be a twist, because I can't say I found this film very entertaining or enjoyable. So I didn't think it would be that good. But I figured they might explain a little bit more, but they don't give you any explanation either. So it's a little bit disappointing.
They do kind of go through the motions, as in the CEO. You've got Tony Goldwyn, who plays Barry Norris, as you said, from Scandal, that he says that this must be a joke. It could be a drill or someone playing a prank. And I've got to admit, once the shutters come down and everyone's all together, I'd be more concerned than he is. I don't know whether he's got a rough idea or he's that confident because he's got previous military experience that he knows he can handle himself. But being like some of the weaker characters, I thought that there'd be more panic settling in, but they don't appear to be panicking at all. It's always Mike Milch's kind of appears for some reason, and I'd love to know his character arc of why he's one step ahead all the time, because he does appear to be, doesn't he?
He's like voice of reason.
But we don't know why. I want to know why. It's really annoying. I'd love to know, like, even if they found his file. I know that's kind of tropey. It's been done in other films. I'd probably slate it. But if they went through people's personnel records and they found that, I don't know, he was a police officer or something like that, that would kind of make him or give him an explanation as to why he's questioning so many things. But there's nothing, is there?
If you're saying that because he's a police officer, he might have a better judgment. Surely someone with military background wouldn't turn out like the CEO does and just go around and do what he does. Surely they would have a decent moral compass and be slightly calmer in that situation.
But if he knows it's kill or be killed, then when it comes to that, if that's what it is, then he's not going to give a fuck, is he? He works in an office full of absolute pussies that, apart from Michael Rooker, he probably could handle himself. The rest of them probably can't. So that could be why. I mean, he could have been in the military and just be a complete wanker. It doesn't mean that he's really nice and he's kind of, his moral compass is great because he's been in the military.
Yeah, I guess. I don't know. I just think if you've done that and have that in your past, you're not just going to be that sort of gung-ho about just killing anyone and everyone just for the sake of it, when you don't really know what's going on.
No, really. I get what you're saying, yeah. And I like, again, the speed of this film. When they're on the rooftop, you know on the rooftop someone is going to die. Like the cinematography, the way it's done, it's shot brilliantly for you just to work out who's going to die. And I obviously thought it's not going to be Sean Gunn, because James Gunn would not have his brother die within the first, like, 20 minutes. But when that girl's head next to him blows up, when he's just talking about chill out, everyone's panicking, it's absolutely fine. And I thought initially that she'd been shot by a sniper.
You guys, quit getting so worked up.
Sorry, what, man?
Bro, did you even happen to read what you signed when you started working for this place? We gave these fuckers the right to do practically whatever the fuck they wanted to do to us.
Oh, kill us.
No, dude. It's a psychological fucking test, man. They want to see how we'll react to this bullshit. Look at me. Look how fucking chill I am. They lose, man. I fucking win. So just relax and take the day off, man. Consider it a present from corporate fucking America.
And you've got problems with this, Carol, with regards to the explosion in the head. I thought it worked really well. And I thought it was a sniper. And that's what led to massive like panic and hysteria. But it's the trackers aren't trackers. They're obviously tiny explosives in their head, which I think is really, really good idea. But you had an issue, Carol, didn't you?
Yeah, I just think, is there the amount of damage that they cause for, they're obviously a tiny, tiny device because they literally just go under the skin. But for the amount of damage it causes to the skull for things to explode outwardly, it would suggest that something has been implanted within their skull.
Yeah, it's a ball bearing.
But it's not in their skull, it's under their skin.
But we never see it, though, do we?
Yeah, but you see them, like, they get it implanted in them. They don't have an operation where they have their skull cut open and have this thing dropped in. They just have it implanted in their skin like a chip for an animal.
But it's the ball bearings that Mike Milt pulls out. I took it that that's what was implanted in everyone's skin, was it not?
Yeah, it is.
But I don't get how that can make the inside of your skull come out if it's on the outside.
But we don't know where it is, do we? We never see them implant it into their skin. They talk about it when Danny's on the first day and they're talking about they've had it done. So we don't know if they cut the back of the head, because when Mike Milch goes to try and cut out his head, he has to get a Stanley knife and he's rooting around ridiculously, obviously, in the base of his kind of skull trying to find it. So I took it that they had a medical procedure and they had it in there. But we don't see it, do we?
I just took it that it was in their skin and just under their skin, like a chip for a dog or a cat. And it wasn't actually that implanted as such. It was just under their skin.
See, that whole incorrect premise has ruined the whole film for you, isn't it? Which is a shame.
Kind of.
You gave in too easy. It's so annoying. But when they're in the, like, the foyer of the building and they just randomly explode a few people's heads, it does look like, and I understand the hysteria, as I said, that people think there's a sniper, they're shooting from somewhere. Obviously, they can't be. And people are just running around everywhere. And it's only when, again, the military experience from Barry, when he looks and he examines the back of someone's skull, that's when you know that it's just these incendiary devices planted in their heads that cause them to blow up. And I like the fact that you don't know throughout this film whose head is going to blow up. I wish they would have pushed it more to get one of the main protagonists to explode, just so you didn't know. But I just think it's a very simple and creative idea. I don't know whether you guys think it's just like, wow, that's far too easy. It's just so boring. But I don't know. I like it. It adds mystery, the suspense as well.
Yeah, but you always knew it wasn't going to be any of the main characters, didn't you? You just knew it was going to be some absolute rando who was going to get it. So it didn't add any suspense, which was sad. I wanted... What was the lady with ginger hair? Red hair, sorry.
What, Peggy? The Peggy. Older lady?
Yeah, because to be fair, she was the person I was a bit scared in case she got a head popped. She did, in the end.
Yeah.
But she was the one I kept, like, kind of... Go on, Peggy! Rusty swimmer.
Yeah, I liked old Peggy. She's a really nice old character. And you can kind of relate to her. Every office has got, like, a Peggy, isn't it? That is just really nice. They kind of do the admin, or they just come in one day a week and just do some kind of menial job. But they're just really lovely. And, yeah, I knew she was going to get it, but I did not want Peggy's head to blow up. But I thought, if it does blow up, let's just make it good, you know? Let's just make it fantastic and crazy. But the scene where Mike goes to cut the explosive out of his head, there's no way, no matter how desperate anyone is to try and get it done, you would not be able, I wouldn't personally be able to cut that deep into my own skull to try and remove this explosive. I just couldn't do it. I know, Steve, you obviously could, because, yeah, you're as cool as they come. Kel?
No, I think I would probably pass out. No, I would definitely pass out.
So where Tony Goldwyn is talking to Evan, the security guard, he knows, and I don't know how he knows, that there's like a cache of guns within the building and that he wants the key. And Evan, to his credit, refuses to give him the key to anything.
You have a key to that armory, right? Where the guards keep their weapons. Anybody else have keys besides you?
No. I mean, maybe them ones outside.
I think I should own one of those keys.
You think you should what?
I mean, I should hold on. Make sure they're safe.
Come on, you know I can't do that, sir.
I'm your boss, sir.
Okay, then I quit. All right, I think it's best I hold on to these keys until somebody lets me out of that fucking door. Don't worry, though. I ain't going to give him to nobody.
How did he know that there was weapons in this building at all? Is it because he's the CEO, or is it just the plot driver? How does he know?
It's just one of those questions, mate. You're not allowed to know how he knows. You just got to accept it.
It just helps the plot line. That's basically it, isn't it?
Yeah, plot driver's got to be done.
And I was really surprised when you've got Michael Rooker and his colleague Lonnie down in the basement trying to work out exactly, because they can't blowtorch their way out of it because it's made of this metal that, like adamantium, that is just indestructible. And then they have an argument. He starts panicking down in the basement. And I did not expect Michael Rooker to get his head caved in with a massive wrench. I mean, the makeup for that, or whether it's special effects, I don't know what it is. It's really, really good, isn't it?
Yeah, I really enjoyed that, to be honest. I was staring at it for ages.
Yeah, you actually see his skull caved in, a massive dent in his skull. And I just thought, once he died, I kind of thought, wow, like James Gunn's willing to kill anyone in this. It doesn't make a difference who you are. If Michael Rooker's going to get it, anyone can get it. And this is witnessed by Danny, who's doing the right thing, who's hiding in the basement, which is kind of what I'd do. But I suppose in the long run, it wouldn't work because you are just a random. And at some point, if everyone's got to kill everyone, you're going to basically end up fighting, aren't you? If it's going to be come down to two, it just comes down to pure luck, doesn't it, of who's left. But they need to kill 30 people. That's what they have to do. So whether they like it or not, they're going to have to start murdering their friends and colleagues, aren't they?
It's my time to shine.
How do you decide who goes first?
I mean, this is a question I would ask you both. Yeah, who would you do first? How would you whittle the numbers down? What would be your method?
I think it's really difficult. I think it depends what kind of weapon you've got, because it seems a lot. I'm saying it, if you've got a knife, like something up close and personal, is very, very difficult, very cold. But if you can do it from a distance where you don't see the fallout, if you could just shoot them, I don't know. I think you just try and get the best weapon you can. And it is sad, but pick on the weakest person. Just try and take out the weakest first.
Okay. Kel, what about you?
Depends who's pissed me off, I think, the most.
Oh, that's
unlucky. It doesn't really matter what weapon I've got. It would just depend. Always pissed me off most recently and the most, and go from there.
So would it matter that you're pretty unpopular at work, that people probably would want to go for you first?
They have to catch me first.
There's only so many places you can go in that building.
Yeah. There's not a lot of places to hide. You'd have to be pretty slick and find somewhere, but you know,
I
though...
I think I'd be all right.
Why is that then?
Well, I'm small, apparently, and I have a small head, so I'd fit into lots of little cubbyholes. So what are you going to do?
Hide your head in a cupboard and leave the rest of your body hanging out?
No, I think that I'm small and I have a small head. I didn't clarify that.
If I can't see them, they can't see me.
Exactly. Yeah. That's how you play hide and seek, isn't it? Close your eyes.
Just stand over a bin on your head.
That's how it works. Yeah, that's how it works. Perfect disguise. That's how I always used to play.
How did they find me? I don't know.
Oh, God.
Never mind. But they do kind of start to panic and they split up. But it's only when Tony Goldwyn, Barry Norris from Scandal fame, he's the first one, and I think it does have to be addressed to the whole group when he does have that conversation in the canteen that at some point we are going to have to start killing each other. Because if we don't, 30 of us aren't dead, then they'll take it out of their hands and 60 will be dead.
There are currently 76 of you left in the building. The time is now 12:47 p.m. By 2:47 p.m., in 2 hours, we want 30 of you dead through whatever means necessary.
Whether they like it or not, the conversation of murdering your friends and colleagues, or if you work with your wife or your family members, that you are going to have to kill them at some point, whether they like it or not. So that's why, there is no hero in this film. There's just a survivor. Or would you disagree with that?
Definitely no hero. It is just...
No, there's no hero.
No, which is interesting because normally all the films we watch, there is the goody, the baddie, the morals. And even if you've got morals in this film, at some point they will have to go out the window and you will have to become the killer, the one it's, we need to do this. But there is a massive difference to doing it for survival and doing it for enjoyment. And you've got John McKinley who does it for enjoyment and Tony Goldwyn does it for enjoyment. I think they're the only two, apart from that other guy with the beard, who appears to be doing it for enjoyment rather than it's the rules that they've been told to by this unknown voice, isn't it?
I don't think anyone's enjoying it as such, do you really?
Yeah, John McKinley, he's definitely enjoying himself. He's having a great time. I don't particularly think this, the guy in charge is enjoying it. I think he is just doing it because it has to be done. But you've got to make the best of a bad situation, haven't you?
You do, and I always think that in whatever film, even in The Rock or in whatever film, John McGinley enjoys whatever he does. He puts 100% into it. He is the creepy kind of character, the very dry sense of humour, and he plays that really well. I only think that someone like Barry enjoys doing it because it's their idea to go up to the safe, the vault, where all the weapons are. And those weapons, and I like the way, and I think it's very clever and sensible that it's discussed, that they are only there for the person who's aware of it for the purpose of this game, to kill more people. There's no other reason. And I think it's a really good idea that he says someone put them there. He goes, God, whoever the voice is, has told us to come and break in and nick these weapons. And that's, I love it that it's told to the audience, because you don't need to make your mind up. And you don't wonder, why are they there? They're in an office. Why have they got fuckloads of weapons? So at some point, this was inevitable, wasn't it?
It's like it was a setup of sorts.
Yeah, I would have liked for more barbaric weapons. I think it would have been good, personally, if the Tannoy would have said, go up to the 55th floor, you will find a bag of weapons, and where it's like a baseball bat with a fucking a 9-inch nail in it and stuff like that. Just so it can get more. That's what they do in Battle Royale. They're each given different kinds of weapons. Some people are unfortunate. They get like a cup or a plate or binoculars, and some get like a machete. But I'd like them to up the stakes, because this is a really violent film. So fuck it. Give them all weapons each. That's what I would have liked. An old granny with a fucking knuckle duster trying to punch someone, you know? Well, Mike and Evan do disrupt them from breaking the guns out. And they really do piss the team off. And even Leandra highlights the fact that, well done, you've made permanent enemies of those fucking three nutcases, which it doesn't make a difference. At some point, they're going to have to clash and they're going to have to meet. So it's better to piss them off now than at some other point in the film, because they've already proved that their intention is to get weapons tooled up. And when it comes to executing people, they're obviously happy about doing it, aren't they?
This is where she pissed me off, because you're completely right there. They're going to try it at some point, so make enemies now instead of trying to be nice to everyone.
Yeah, that's what I think. I thought Mike was exactly right. Go in there with the right approach. Otherwise, everyone is going to get bullied by these, well, not three of them, because Terry Winter has proved that he's just a complete bloody Larry the Lamb following them around. But John McKinley and Tony Goldwyn, they are the bullies of this. They are the stronger the characters, the alpha males. So, yeah, Mike's right to go in and just highlight the facts. Plus, at this time of the film, he's got a gun that I'm not going to be fucked with. I thought that was the right approach, and I don't know what her problem was. And plus, they've said one person is going to go out of this alive, one person. And that's what annoys me when Leandra and Mike are kind of making plans whilst they're in the building. I don't know if that's bullshit, just to kind of give each other courage or not panic. But even if it was them two left, one of them would have to kill the other, wouldn't they?
Yeah. And I know Mike's was always looking for the happy ending and always looking for another route out. But yeah, it's inevitable. So that's why you would do it early doors, wouldn't you? Because it would just be easier that way. Instead of just being left one-on-one and being like, look, I'm really sorry. I'll just get rid of him in a melee. But, right, see you later.
Yeah, and I also thought Sean Gunn, really, I wanted him to die early in this film. for a short film, what he had to do was padded out and pointless. When he said there was a poison in the water and it's or a kind of a brain activating substance that made people kill each other, that like hallucinogenic, that he went around and emptied the water barrels, it was just pointless. It didn't do anything for me. I wanted him to die by this point.
Yeah, his only move in this was kind of collecting all the ball bearing devices later in the film, and that could have been done quite early on anyway.
When they go to the roof and hold out the banners to try and get rescued, that was just like a no-win situation. They were never going to ever succeed at doing that. And considering it's Mike's idea, and he's meant to be the only one with kind of who's a bit lucid to common sense, they were always going to get shot down and kind of figuratively and literally, weren't they?
But where from? Because there was no sniper towers that high.
But how did they know that?
Because they could see over the fucking wall.
But you look over the wall, you're going to get shot, aren't you? That's the thing.
Yeah, but they did look over the wall. So yeah.
And poor little bloody Keith got shot.
Yep. Yeah, but how? Yeah, that irritated me. How? They knew that there wasn't anything there because they'd looked over it before. So before anyone's head had exploded when they went up there initially to try and get signal and all of that. So they knew what was out there or not out there.
I would have thought there was snipers, to be honest. I would have thought if they wanted to kill you, they would have killed you at some point. And that there could have been a sniper as a contingency somewhere just to take people out. And so I wouldn't have gone for the roof because you just don't know. It's that unknown. And I just thought that it seemed a bit out of character for Mike to come up with such a dickish idea. And even he looks defeated and kind of pissed off of himself when he's coming down the stairs to think that that's a fucking stupid idea. And even then, Leandra's going, oh, you okay? I mean, I think now, stop looking after each other. Don't be teams. Just go for the kill. Just go killing each other.
I think that's a bit harsh, especially if you actually care about someone. It's very easy to sort of sit there and go, nope, I'm going to kill you. But I think it'd be a lot more difficult to do that in reality.
I know, in reality, but people's heads have exploded and you're getting shot whilst you're on the roof. I don't know, you can kind of forgive someone's behaviour like Barry Norris's when he breaks that girl's neck. Who offers herself up for sex later on in the film, because it's just got to be done. You're just a number. You're nothing, and you're not going to get out of this with a partner, with a team. You might succeed so far with a team, but after that, you're on your own. So I think you've got to get to a stage where you kill people and just start doing it. And you can be forgiven for that because it's just dog-eat-dog in this now.
I still don't think that would be easy to do. And I think it would be up until, like, the last minute when it was one or the other. Up until that point, you would still have, like, well, you might not, but normal people, would have, like, a caring bone in their body where they're wanting to make sure that the other person's okay.
Yeah, I get what you're saying, and I do have that. That is my kind of personality. And that's
not
my
to
kind
give
of.
A shit.
No, my default is to kind of help other people and not go around murdering them. I think, yeah, don't worry about that. I think you do get to the stage, or you would in this, when reality hits home. And I don't know, obviously, I've never killed anyone, but maybe after you killed your first one, look at John C. McGinley. After he's killed his first one, we don't know his history. He might just be a fucking serial killer or a rapist. We really, really don't know. But he gets quite into it. And it turns out it's quite good fun on his account. So, and Barry Norris, he's done it before. We know he's got military experience. And as soon as they come down the stairs, Mike gets smashed in the face with a fire extinguisher. And then poor old Evan tries to be a hero. It doesn't give the keys over and just chucks him down the stairs. And then McGinley just stabs him and kills him. Fair play to him. It's got to be done. And you can't look at him as the baddie, which is the real dilemma in this, because he's doing what's got to be done.
See, that's why if it were me, I wouldn't hesitate, because there's a task that needs to be completed. Let's not dilly-dally about, because it has to be done one way or the other. So why fuck about?
And it's interesting because there are no heroes or there are no villains in this film. There are people who are making the right decision that has to be made. It's a real scruples, isn't it? It's like, After this bit, they get everyone down into the foyer, apart from Danny, who's hiding still. And then this is where Barry takes the lead about people with children, and he puts everyone in different groups.
I'm going to need everyone with children under the age of 18 to step forward.
Why?
Barry, you can't do
Quickly, quickly, quickly.
Excuse me, sir. Sir, sir. I send money home to my parents every month for my little brother.
Is your little brother made out of your sperm, cocksucker?
And I think he's doing what has to be done. No one likes it, but people are too frightened or their moral compass won't allow them to do it. And they do start executing people. And in any true James Gunn-style film, it plays this operatic music, which is fantastic. It really suits this actual scene of people getting executed. And looking at this now as we're going through, I think I am wrong. He doesn't enjoy this. It possibly is, as I think you said, Kels, possibly that McGinley's the only one who enjoys killing people. But it's a hard decision, and it has to be made. People have to be executed.
No, he's doing what needs to be done.
Which is good, because I think it's clever, because you can't hate him for it. You can think in the end, I want him to die, but why? Because he's getting done what needs to be done. And the only one who's a massive pussy is the one who Terry Winter, who's the sheep, who just as he's about to shoot Mike, and he grasses Mike up for when he asks him for the gun, and that the lights go out and Danny tricks all the lights. And then it just turns into a bit of a massacre. She's kind of responsible. She kicks off what needs to be done, that people were just fucking killing each other. But the build-up where he goes and executes people is quite tragic, isn't it?
Yeah, especially with the music, which doesn't make sense because they've got no phone signal, but they can get like an FM radio to get music, but that's neither here nor there. But yeah, you can tell he doesn't, there is no fun to be had at this point.
You think it would have damaged his character if he was enjoying it and smiling, or do you feel sympathy for him because he's doing what needs to be done, whereas McGinley is enjoying it?
Yeah, I think that still, it gives you a moral dilemma as a viewer, because you're like, well, I want to paint you as the bad guy, but you're not technically a bad guy, because everyone hates McGinley because he is just being sadistic, whereas old Barry Scott is just really struggling with making these decisions.
Yeah. It is a scruples for him. It's a real dilemma that he doesn't know what he's going to do. And I honestly thought when that moment where Terry Winter corners Leandra and she's holding her, like, her shoes with those big heels, that one of them was going to end up in Terry Winter's head. I was really disappointed that that wasn't the case, that she didn't use it as a weapon. But I did like the fact she got the guillotine blade and attacked him with that. That was good, because they're sharp as fuck, aren't they?
I mean, they can cut through paper.
Paper cuts hurt.
I'd say getting hit with a guillotine blade would hurt more, but she
didn't. I would have preferred the heel.
Would have preferred the heel in the head. That would have been a great death, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
They missed a trick there. But the back of his head blows up instantly, and they go through their rounds because they haven't killed enough people. I think they killed 29 people.
You've come up one body short. We're sorry to inform you that 31 additional employees will now be eliminated.
And this is good. I like the random killings of people just accepting it or think they might have got away with it. Where the last one, where you see Keith, when all the heads have exploded, and as we say, poor old Peggy gets it, and he's like, it's finished, it's stopped, and then his head explodes and he's dead. It's just quite funny, isn't it? If they're going to make something fun, make this fun.
Yeah, I think this is very, very James Gunn, this little moment. Have we had the lift death by this point?
No, we got Robert Jerez, who's hiding in the lift with Danny, and it all goes fucking Pete Tong. His death is the worst one out of all of them, isn't it? Where he gets crushed. I wanted him ripped in half, like Final Destination, you know?
Yeah. I won't say he's my worst death, though.
Okay, what would be your worst death in this? Have we had it yet?
It is coming. I will let you know when it comes.
And were you surprised when you've got the character who says to Mr. Norris, like, I know you've been looking at me, I know what you want, and she starts to take her shirt off. Were you surprised he killed her, or that he didn't kind of take advantage of her offer?
I know what you want. Look, Mr. Norris, you can have me if you want.
Stop.
again, Mr. Bullen.
I wasn't surprised, but I like what he did in the sense that he's like, I can't waste a bullet.
I was really surprised he broke her neck like that.
I didn't think he'd get that close and be that hands-on, because he obviously liked her, and that's a very personal way to do it.
Yeah. Did he do that because it was a quick death, or genuinely because of the bullets? Because I know he says you're not worth a bullet. Was that a compliment he was trying to say?
No.
I don't know. Don't overthink it kind of thing.
Kel, in your position, you're a female, you're in the office, you're in this situation. Would you do what she did?
What, try and have sex with him so he didn't kill me?
Yeah.
No. I might try and seduce him so I could shoot him myself, but I wouldn't have sex with him, no.
Suffocate him with your thighs.
James Bond style.
If that works, then yeah, it's a win-win.
I think I'd try and seduce him. I'd walk up to him with my flies undone, my shirt unbuttoned, and I'd do my best kind of mince, and I'd try and seduce him. I reckon I could do it.
That would be my weakness.
Yeah. You are a proper flirt, so you'd probably do quite well at that.
I'd do anything to survive. I really, really would. And I mean anything, Steve. I really do. Just remember, if this happens, be in the same building as me.
Yeah, I'll make a note. Don't you worry.
Fantastic.
I'll find a use for you.
But yeah, we do get Robert Jerez, who dies in the lift. And you could, when he dies, because he gets squashed, that it traps Barry Norris in the lift. And you kind of think, at least when he's in the lift, no one can kill him. And he might kind of live out of this. Would you try and stay in the lift, or would you try your best to escape?
I've only ever been stuck in a lift once, and it was an unenjoyable situation. So I would do my best to escape.
Were people trying to murder each other outside of the lift, though, at the time?
No, but it was a glass, and it was in the middle of Gunwharf Quays.
Were you clothed?
Fortunately, I was clothed, and I had to call someone. It was a help number, and they're like, hi. It was like customer service or something. It's like, I was like, I'm stuck in one of your lifts. And they're like, oh. So, yeah.
How long were you stuck there for?
It was only about 5 minutes, but it started as a joke saying, oh, could you imagine if this lift got stuck? And I did the little, you know, when you do the little hop.
Yeah.
And it stopped.
Who was in there with you?
My partner at the time.
I bet she hated you.
Yeah, we would like, it was more embarrassing because it was just a glass lift and people were walking past and just not making eye contact. So you couldn't get anyone to get you help.
The great British public. They're so caring, aren't they?
Yeah.
Brilliant.
So, yeah, there was no alarm button. And so I had to call like a number on like an advertisement for Gunwharf Quays. So it just went through to like this just random office.
Nice.
Yeah. So that's why I'd be escaping.
I don't blame you. I don't blame you. When we get Leandra and John McGinley kind of facing off, and obviously there's been bad blood between them, I thought that he was going to kill her. I honestly did. I thought that he might die, but he would kill her quite violently. And I mean, he does take out two characters whilst this is going on, and one of them thankfully being Sean Gunn. But I didn't expect Leandra to go absolutely psycho with a fire axe and just cave his head in again and again and again. And it's really violent because you do see everything, don't you?
I thought the rage was really good.
Mm.
Gotcha. You really connected with this character, didn't you?
Yes, yes, I did. The rage was immense. I liked it.
You sick woman.
Yes. Well,
pretty hardcore. I did feel sorry this part for Danny when you see her doing Die Hard style through the lifts, jumping from kind of a barrier to barrier, and she manages to get in a lift to try and escape, and meanwhile go down to the foyer where you've got Mike and Leandra, and you get Barry come out and started shooting people, and poor old Danny thinks she's made it. The lift door opens and then she just gets shot in the head, doesn't she?
And this was my worst death. Not because it was like gruesome or anything, but because I genuinely thought there would be something about Danny. So when this happened, I was like, I couldn't believe how wrong I was.
Yeah.
I thought she would. Yeah, because she doesn't really have any lines. I thought she'd be the one to kind of, it would dwindle down to her and Mike, and she would just do something to kill Mike. So I was like, when the door was open, it just popped her. I was like, I've got this all wrong. I've got it all wrong.
It is funny, though, isn't it? Because she goes through so much. She kind of hides and just moves and stays out of sight. And then as soon as she gets into the open, it happens to be the fact that Barry's there and just takes her out. And it's, and in the kind of the shooting, the melee, that's when Leandra gets shot. And, you know, I was quite pleased that she was out of the picture. I mean, I know Mike loves her, but at some point, like, he would have to kill her. Or they would make the decision and flip the switch and blow his head up or her head up. So it had to happen, which just leaves Mike and Barry together to duke it out. And what did you think of the fight between them two guys?
It's a bit rubbish.
It was too slow and just a bit boring.
It wasn't realistic. When you think the experience that Barry's got of a military experience and the way the fight starts when he's in, when he's got Mike in chokeholds and things like that, I just don't think that Mike is a fighter, that he would be able to hold his own, that he would be able to, like, physically as a specimen, Barry's much bigger. Tony Goldwyn is a big guy, that he would take Mike out. I just thought it was pretty unbelievable. But saying that, I did like the fact that he picked up that sellotape holder, those weighted down ones, and just went to town and started caving his skull in, which I did like.
Yeah, that was good because I'm a fan of caving in skulls.
Yeah.
But that was the only highlight of the film. Not the film, sorry, the fight. Because up until then, it was... Barry should have had, like, just gone to school and just taken him down, like, 5 seconds with his, like, background.
Yeah, because the good thing about this film, the clever thing, due to the nature of the story... is that there is no hero. There is no one who you want to come out. I didn't really mind, because they played it so well, that Barry didn't like killing people, didn't like executing them, and you saw that. That for me, if Barry would have killed Mike, I would have been quite happy with it. He probably wouldn't have had the savvy that Mike's got to do what he does at the end of it. But as soon as he kills Barry, all of the shutters come up, and that's when we're introduced... to the voice.
Congratulations, Mr. Melch. You were the last remaining employee of Belco Industries.
Played by Greg Harry, who's also been in Guardian, Sliver, Payback and Scandal. I don't know why he's got all that makeup on and such a scarred face, do you?
No, it doesn't make sense.
They don't explain it.
No, it doesn't add anything at all, does it? To the journey he's been through, we don't really know anything about it. But he does see the control panel with everyone's names on it. So he knows he's the one who's flicking the switches and he's the voice. And his intention is to ask Mike a series of questions.
Which emotion most accurately describes how you feel in this moment? A. Sad. B. Relieved. C. Confused. D.
So you've been watching everything that we do in there.
We are not here to answer your questions. You are here to answer ours.
The big bad wasn't bad for me.
It just made it seem like it was an actual experiment, almost like it's a feedback form. They don't care what's happened. It was just a case of, on a scale of 1 to 5, how satisfied are you with your experience? Which made them, to me, seem like they were just so emotionally unattached to everybody. They just didn't care, as long as they got their results. The questions did work in a way, because 79 people have just died, and he wants to know, you know, how was your experience? What could we change?
Yeah, it's very cold questions, isn't it? I'd like to have seen it done a bit different. I don't know how different or why, but the twist in it, when he says that he's put those explosives, your guys didn't search me, and they certainly didn't realise I put explosives in every single one.
Well, then I suppose you saw me pick up those explosives.
And where are these explosives now?
On you. You fucking piece of shit.
And then he rushes over to the control panel and blows them up. Were you kind of pleased with that, Carol? Did that surprise you? Did you just think, oh, fuck off, I've had enough of this now? What did you think when he did that and kills everyone in the room?
Kind of a bit of both. I didn't see, like, I was surprised that he had had that kind of peace of mind to get them and take the ball bearing bomb things in the first place. Because I don't think my mind would have been that stable to think, oh yeah, do you know what, I'll take those, they might come in handy later. So that surprised me, but it was also quite nice that he did have the last say, so I thought it was quite good. But I definitely wouldn't have had the level head to go, yeah, they're useful, let's keep those.
No, I was really surprised. I thought it was a good twist that in the panic of the moment of getting picked up by those soldiers and dragged to the hangar, But yeah, he had the sense and the mind to put those explosives in and obviously run over to the board where he saw everyone's names and blow them up. I thought it was good. And I did like the fact that when it pulls away, I think there's 63 monitors at the end of the film that show various stages of the experiment of different office blocks where people have murdered people or people in the middle of murdering them. And you see the scale of the experiment. And it all, obviously, it's Belko because some of them, Belko is in the background, that this is worldwide. I like that. I think that's really interesting. And it kind of really puts in perspective that these people are fucking sick that they're doing this all around the world to see how people react.
Yeah. And it basically says phase one complete, beginning phase two. So this is far from over.
I'd like to see, and I don't know if there is a second one, I didn't even bother looking, to be honest, of what phase two can be, and whether these people can just walk away from this experience or whether they're picked up and given non-disclosures to not actually talk about it. I mean, where do you go from here if you've kind of gone through this experience, you know?
Probably to like an asylum of sorts.
Yeah, because no one's going to believe you, are they?
No. Belko would be able to cover it up. They've made this thing. They're going to cover it up quickly, aren't they? So
the kingpin at the top of it is dead.
Well, he's not the kingpin, is it? Because there's people watching the other screens. He's like supervisor. There's a duty manager somewhere.
He's running this experiment at this particular plant in Bogota.
Bogota, but yes.
Why you got to do that? This is not an educational geographic podcast.
It annoys me the whole time.
But you've let him say it the whole time and then you correct him at the end.
It's Bogota. What did you call it? Bogota?
Yeah.
She's been saying Bogota the whole time. It's pissing me off.
I didn't even listen. Have you said it before then?
No, I've not said it at all.
It's not Bogota, it's Bogota.
Okay.
It is. Listen to the film. They even say it in there.
Okay. I said okay. Calm down.
Bogota treating you good so far?
Well, I don't even know where this place is. Where is it?
Colombia.
Never heard of it.
So that is the Belko experiment 2016. Kelly, what's your opinions? Tell me.
No, I didn't like it. I didn't enjoy it. It's not something I would recommend. It was quite boring, I found. Some of the deaths were quite good. I did like some of the deaths. But other than that, no. I thought it was maybe a 1 or even a 0.5. So no, not good for me.
Would you recommend it to anyone? Not really.
Not at all.
I'm really surprised you didn't like it more, I have to say. It's quite fast moving. And I don't mean this in an insulting way. It isn't a lot to think about. It's just a question of scruples and killing and a test of people's personality. So I thought you'd like it more than you did. I'm quite surprised.
But there's fast pace and then there's just laziness because it's so fast. Lots of things aren't explained. And there's questions that you think, well, why is that in there? Why do they know there's guns there? Why are there guns there? None of it's ever really explained. So it's like there's fast pace. And then there's just, I can't be bothered to include that, so we're just going to skip over that and hope the audience just roll with it.
No, I get that. It is, I don't know whether I would have wanted it more padded out, to be honest, but I do get what you're saying completely, that they do miss, like, massive kind of people's character arc of how they got there and how they know what they know. That, yeah, why didn't Evan, a security guard, go for the gun straight away, even if it's to hide them? Why didn't he do it? But yeah, there's massive bits missing. Mm. But Steve, did this work for you or are you in a kind of going in the same direction as Kel?
I don't hate it that much. I'd give it a 2 out of 5. I suppose it's a poor man's battle royale or the wish version, as people would say. If it had been a bit more deeper storyline, a bit more character progression, a bit more gruesome, I suppose I would have enjoyed it more, but I feel like it was too rushed. You know, you didn't get any background to anyone. You didn't get attached to any characters. It was just missing something.
Yeah. Yeah. Would you recommend this or not really?
No, I wouldn't like bring it up in conversation. No one's going to miss out on not seeing it.
No, I have to say, I agree with both of you, sir. I'd probably give it about 1.5, 2. I don't think I'd recommend it. There is much better out there. If I wanted this kind of genre, I'd go to Battle Royale, definitely. And that's if, obviously, it's subtitled. So that, again, puts people off watching certain things. But I enjoyed seeing people like John C. McGinley and Tony Goldwyn just in these films, and Michael Rooker as well, kind of those people. But it didn't offer a lot. It's a vicious circle, as in, I would have wanted more character arc, but I wouldn't have wanted a longer film, because I think I'd had enough. So it couldn't have really given me any more. I would have been bored. But I did enjoy it for an hour and a half. It just wasted time. I wouldn't watch it again if it was on TV. But that is it. That's the Belko Experiment. If it's on Amazon Prime in the UK. So if you've got that and you like what you've heard, just go and check that out. If you've gone through the list, you would have seen on our queue, we've got the Taken films 1, 2, and 3 reviewed by myself, Steve, James, and Kelly all at some point. So that's on there to listen to. In true style, we don't know what we're doing next week. It is Halloween, so whether we're going to keep going with another kind of gory scare fest, I'm really not too sure, but there will be something out. But we'll be back next week with another podcast. Thank you.